2010. When Linda Saubers got home that Friday afternoon at 3:30, Pete was sitting at the kitchen table drinking a cup of cocoa. His hair was still damp from the shower. She hung her coat on one of the hooks by the back door and placed the inside of her wrist against his forehead again. "Cool as a cucumber," she pronounced. "Do you feel better?" "Yeah," he said. "When Tina came home, I made her peanut butter crackers." "You're a good brother. Where is she now?"
"Ellen's. Where else?"
Linda rolled her eyes and Pete laughed.
"Mother of mercy, is that the dryer, I hear?"
"Yeah, there were a bunch of clothes in the basket, so I washed them. Don't worry, I followed the directions on the door and they came out okay."
She bent down and kissed his temple. "Aren't you the little doobie?"
"I try," Pete said.
He closed his right hand to hide the blister on his palm. The first envelope came on a snow-showery Thursday not quite a week later. The address, Mr. Thomas Saubers, 23 Sycamore Street, was typed. Stuck on the upper right-hand corner was a 44-cent stamp featuring the Year of the Tiger. There was no return address on the upper left. Tom, the only member of Clan Saubers home at midday, tore it open in the hall, expecting either some sort of come-on or another past-due notice. God knew there had been plenty of those lately. But it wasn't a come-on, and it wasn't a past-due. It was money. The rest of the mail, catalogs for expensive stuff they couldn't afford and advertising circulars addressed to occupant, fell from his hand and fluttered around his feet unnoticed. In a low voice, almost a growl, Tom Sauber said, "What the fuck is this?" When Linda came home, the money was sitting in the middle of the kitchen table. Tom was seated before the neat little pile with his chin resting on his folded hands. He looked like a general considering a battle plan.
"What's that?" Linda asked.
$500. He continued to look at the bills, 850s and 520s. It came in the mail.
"From who?"
"I don't know."
She dropped her briefcase, came to the table, and picked up the stack of currency. She counted it, then looked at him with wide eyes.
"My God, Tommy, what did the letter say?"
"There was no letter, just the money."
"But who would..."
"I don't know, Lynn, but I know one thing."
"What?"
"We can sure use it."
"Holy shit," Pete said when they told him. He had stayed late at school for intramural volleyball and didn't come in until almost dinner time.
"Don't be vulgar," Linda said, sounding distracted. The money was still on the kitchen table.
"How much?"
And when his father told him,
"Who sent it?"
"That's a good question," Tom said. "Now for Double Jeopardy, where the scores can really change."
It was the first joke Pete had heard him make in a very long time. Tina came in.
"Daddy's got a fairy godmother, that's what I think. Hey, Dad, Mom, look at my fingernails. Ellen got sparkle polish and she shared."
"Excellent look for you, my little pumpkin," Tom said. First a joke, then a compliment. Those things were all it took to convince Pete that he had done the right thing. Totally the right thing. They couldn't exactly send it back, could they? Not without a return address, they couldn't. And by the way, when was the last time Dad had called teens his little pumpkin? Linda gave her son a piercing look.
"You don't know anything about this, do you?"
"Uh-uh. But can I have some?"
"Dream on," she said, and turned to her husband, hands on hips. "Tom, someone's obviously made a mistake." Tom considered this, and when he spoke, there was no arcing and barking. His voice was calm. "That doesn't seem likely." He pushed the envelope toward her, tapping his name and address.
"Yes, but..."
"But me no buts, Lynn. We owe the oil company, and before we pay them, we have to pay down your MasterCard, or you're going to lose it."
"Yes, but..."
"Lose the credit card, lose your credit rating." Still not arcing and barking, calm and reasonable, persuasive. To Pete, it was as if his father had been suffering from a high fever that had just broken. He even smiled and touched her hand.
"It so happens that for now your credit rating is the only one we've got.
so we have to protect it. Besides, Tina could be right. Maybe I've got a fairy godmother.
No, Pete thought. A fairy godson is what you've got.
Tina said, Oh, wait, I know where it really came from.
They turned to her. Pete felt suddenly warm all over. She couldn't know, could she? How could she? Only he'd said that stupid thing about buried treasure and...
Where, hun? Linda asked. The emergency fund thingy. It must have got some more money, and now they're spreading it out.
Pete let out a soundless breath of air, only realizing as it passed his lips that he had been holding it.
Tom ruffled her hair.
They wouldn't send cash, Bunkin. They'd send a check. Also a bunch of forms to sign.
Pete went to the stove. I'm making more cocoa. Does anyone want some?
Turned out they all did. The envelopes kept coming. The price of postage went up, but the amount never changed. An extra $6,000 per annum, give or take. Not a huge sum, but tax-free and just enough to keep the Saubers family from drowning in debt. The children were forbidden to tell anyone.
Tina will never be able to keep it to herself, Linda told Tom one night. You know that, don't you? She'll tell her idiot friend, and Ellen Briggs will broadcast it to everyone she knows.
But Tina kept the secret, partly because her brother, whom she idolized, told her she would never be allowed in his room again if she spilled the beans, and mostly because she remembered the Archie-Barkies. Pete stowed the cash envelopes in the cobweb-festooned hollow behind a loose baseboard in his closet. Once every 4 weeks or so, he took out $500 and put it in his backpack along with an addressed envelope, one of several dozen he had prepared at school on a computer in the school's business headroom. He did the envelopes after intramurals one late afternoon when the room was empty. He used a variety of city mailboxes to send them on their way to Mr. Thomas Saubers of 23 Sycamore Street, going about this family-sustaining charity with the craft of a master criminal. He was always afraid that his mom would discover what he was up to, object, probably strenuously, and things would go back to the way they had been. Things weren't perfect now. There was still the occasional archy-barky, but he supposed things weren't perfect in any family outside those old TV sitcoms on Nick at Night. They could watch Nick at Night, and Cartoon Network, and MTV, and everything else, because, ladies and gentlemen, the cable was back. In May, another good thing happened. Dad got a part-time job with a new real estate company as something called a pre-sell investigator. Pete didn't know what that was and didn't give shit one. Dad could do it on his phone and the home computer. It brought in a little money, and those were the things that mattered. Two other things mattered in the months after the money started coming in. Dad's legs were getting better. That was one thing. In June of 2010, when the perpetrator of the so-called City Center massacre was finally caught, Tom began walking without his crutches some of the time, and he also began stepping down on the pink pills. The other thing was more difficult to explain, but Pete knew it was there. So did Tina. Dad and Mom felt, well, blessed. And now when they argued, they looked guilty as well as mad, as if they were shitting on the mysterious good fortune that had befallen them. Often they would stop and talk about other things before the shit got deep. Often it was the money they talked about and who could be sending it. These discussions came to nothing, and that was good. I will not be caught, Pete told himself. I must not, and I will not. One day in August of that year, Dad and Mom took Tina and Ellen to a petting zoo called Happydale Farm. This was the opportunity Pete had been patiently waiting for, and as soon as they were gone, he went back to the stream with two suitcases. After making sure the coast was clear, he dug the trunk out of the embankment again and loaded the notebooks into the suitcases. He reburied the trunk and then went back to the house with his booty. In the upstairs hall, he pulled down the ladder and carried the suitcases up to the attic. This was a small, low space, chilly in winter and stifling in summer. The family rarely used it. Their extra stuff was still stored in the garage. The few relics up here were probably left over from one of the previous families that had owned 23 Sycamore. There was a dirty baby carriage listing on one wheel. a standing lamp with tropical birds on the shade, old issues of Red Book and Good Housekeeping tied up with twine, a pile of moldy blankets that smelled like yuck. Pete piled the notebooks in the farthest corner and covered them with the blankets. But first he grabbed one at random, sat under one of the attic's two hanging light bulbs, and opened it. The writing was cursive and quite small, but carefully made and easy to read. There were no cross-outs, which Pete thought remarkable. Although he was looking at the first page of the notebook, the small circled number at the top was 482, making him think that this was continued not just from one of the other notebooks, but from half a dozen. Half a dozen at least. Chapter 27. The back room of the Drover was the same as it had been 5 years before. The same smell of ancient beer mingled with the stink of the stockyards and the tang of diesel from the trucking depots that fronted this half of Nebraska's great emptiness. Stu Logan looked the same, too. Here was the same white apron, the same suspiciously black hair, even the same parrots and macaws necktie strangling his rosy neck. "Why, it's Jimmy Gold, as I live and breathe," he said and smiled in his old dislikable way that said, "We don't care for each other, but let's pretend. Have you come to pay me what you owe, then?" "I have," Jimmy said, and touched his back pocket where the pistol rested. It felt small and final, a thing capable, if used correctly and with courage, of paying all debts. "Then step in," Logan said. "Have a drink. You look dusty." "I am," Jimmy said, "and along with a drink I could use..." A horn honked on the street. Pete jumped and looked around guiltily as if he'd been whacking off instead of reading. What if they'd come home early because that doofus Ellen had gotten car sick or something? What if they found him up here with the notebooks? Everything could fall apart. He shoved the one he had been reading under the old blankets. Phew, they stank! And crawled back to the trap door, sparing a glance for the suitcases. No time for them. Going down the ladder, the change in temperature from boiling hot to August normal made him shiver. Pete folded the ladder and shoved it up, wincing at the squeak and bang the trapdoor made when it snapped shut on its rusty spring. He went into his bedroom and peered out at the driveway. Nobody there. False alarm. Thank God. He returned to the attic and retrieved the suitcases. He put them back in the downstairs closet, took a shower, once more remembering to clean up the tub afterwards, then dressed in clean clothes and lay down on his bed. He thought, it's a novel. With that many pages, it's pretty much gotta be. And there might be more than one because no single novel's long enough to fill all those books. Not even the Bible would fill all those books. Also, it was interesting. He wouldn't mind hunting through the notebooks and finding the one where it started, seeing if it really was good. Because you couldn't tell if a novel was good from just a single page, could you? Pete closed his eyes and began to drift napward. Ordinarily, he wasn't much of a day sleeper, but it had been a busy morning. The house was empty and quiet, and he decided to let himself go. Why not? Everything was right, at least right now, and that was his doing. He deserved a nap. That name, though. Jimmy Gold. Pete could swear he'd heard it before. In class, maybe? Mrs. Swidrowski giving them background on one of the authors they were reading? Maybe. She liked to do that. Maybe I'll Google it later on, Pete thought. I could do that. I could. He slept.